Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we find out how Hollywood icon Hedy Lamarr is responsible for some modern technology, hear about one writer's adventures after getting stuck in her bathroom, and we talk to B-movie actress Tura Sitana, star of Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Below the surface of most works of art are the artist's raw materials: paint, canvas, plastic, metal, wood. Artists have their own reasons for choosing materials, some practical, some aesthetic, some quirky and personal. Independent producer Catherine Giardo has the story of two musical instrument builders, one who combines ordinary objects to make otherworldly music, and one who crafts extraordinary musical sculptures.
My name is Oliver Tachico. I'm an instrument builder, sculptor, designer.
I'm Bart Hopkin. I'm the guy that runs something called Experimental Musical Instruments. People all over the place making all kinds of interesting things with which to make music.
I visited these two experimental instrument builders in their workshops. I wanted to see and hear how they chose the building blocks of their sonic art. I asked Bart Hopkin what he looks for in choosing materials to build musical instruments.
There's a certain amount of mythology or fairy tale about this when people talk about Stradivarius and his famous varnishes and this kind of stuff. And there's undoubtedly some truth to that, but a lot of it is more romantic than scientific. Most musical instruments begin with an initial vibrating body of some sort, and somehow that pattern of oscillation has to get into the air and get into people's ears.
It doesn't matter if he's talking about a Stradivarius or a styrofoam. When he's going to make an instrument, Hopkin sees stuff, mainly as it relates to how it will produce sound. Like this styrofoam cooler strung with rubber bands, this humble instrument embodies many of the sound-making properties Hopkin has been explaining. Hopkin talks about some of the qualities that make different materials produce sound differently.
A very, very important feature of different sounding materials is internal damping. How readily do waves propagate in the material as opposed to dissipating themselves mostly into heat? Things that do not have a lot of internal damping will sustain vibrations much longer. Damping effects usually affect high frequencies, so that materials that have very little internal damping tend to have much brighter sounds associated with more high frequencies present. Here's an example, the difference between a nylon string guitar and a steel string guitar. You know, the steel string guitar has these ringing tones. The nylon string guitar is more warm and woody. A lot of that is simply because the nylon strings themselves have greater internal damping than the very, very hard steels that are used in steel strings nowadays.
When Bart Hopkin looks at stuff for building instruments, he's looking mainly for how well it's going to work acoustically. Designer and musical sculptor Oliver Tachico, on the other hand, is just as concerned with how his raw materials look as he is with how they'll sound.
Some of it has to do with the tools that I have and the capacity I have to work with certain materials, and that dictates a lot of how things look.
Although they spend a lot of time crafting and wrestling with materials, both Tachico and Hopkin have made instruments that incorporate water, an unpredictable element that can't be shaped, sanded, or fixed. Hopkin shows me his vaguely lute-shaped instrument, played on the lap, made out of a steel mixing bowl.
With some rigid brazing rods brazed onto it, which are played with a bow, the vibration is transmitted to the body of this vessel.
The bottom of the bowl, which contains water, acts like a diaphragm, a surface that vibrates in response to sound. This is Tachico's most recent water sculpture, Sirens. It's basically 11 U-shaped arcs with tubes inside and penny whistles at the ends of the tubes. Motors rock the arcs back and forth, moving the water, which pushes air out of the tubes through the penny whistles.
The test piece sounded like whales. So I thought, well, maybe I'll make it look like the ribs of a whale, because they're going to be these U-shaped pieces out of plywood. The movement is totally random. It's like the sea, ebb and flow and in and out of phase.
I'm Catherine Girardeau in San Francisco.
This is Sidetrack. When writer Annie Lala moved to New York City, she didn't realize the sorts of adventures she would have right off the bat, and in her bathroom. Here's the story as told to independent producer Eric Winnick.
My name is Annie Lala. I'm from Toronto, Canada, and I currently live in Greenwich Village, New York City. Quit my job in Toronto last July because I secretly always dreamed of being a writer. So I knew New York is the land of where dreams come true. So I moved to New York to become a writer and start my own magazine. So I got to New York and I'm looking for an apartment and I finally find one I love. And it's the second day in my apartment and I'm in the bathroom and I close the door. And when I try to open the door, I find that I'm unable to do so. So I'm pulling on the knob. I pull harder. I pull with all my might. I pull until my fingers are red and sweaty, and I can't open the door. Okay, fine. So I look around the bathroom looking for a lever or something to pry in the corner of the door to get it opened, and there is nothing in my bathroom. I've just moved in. There's not even a bar of soap. So I sit down on the edge of my bathtub, take a deep breath, and I go, okay, let's try it again. So I grab onto the handle, and I'm pulling as hard as I can. Now, I've not locked the door. The reason the door is stuck is because it's a recently painted apartment, and I guess the door frame still had moist paint. I don't know what was going on, but I could not open this door for the life of me. I do another session of pulling and huffing and puffing at the top of my skill, as much muscle as I can, and I cannot open this door. So I have a little bit of a laugh. I think this is quite ridiculous, the situation I'm in. This is amusing. You know, if I was watching this in a movie, I'd be laughing. So I sit down on the toilet, I take a deep breath, and I think, what can I do? So here's the deal. I'm in the bathroom, and my phone is outside on the bed. It has all my phone numbers in it of all my friends. Nobody even knows I live in this apartment. I've just moved in 2 days ago, and no one knows where I am, where it is, and no one in the building even knows about me. So I'm trying to think what I can do. I start yelling, and there's a tiny window in my bathroom. So I turn around, and I look out the window. It's literally 1 foot by 1 foot. And it looks out to a quiet little alley, which is perfect to have an apartment leaning over if you're trying to be a writer in New York. However, if you're stuck in a bathroom on a winter afternoon, this is the absolutely worst alley to have your apartment lean onto. I look out the window. I mean, my face is pressed up against the glass, and I'm trying to see who's down there. I'm five stories above the main street level, and I don't see anyone. Like, this is an abandoned old alley that hardly anyone ever walks down. So I'm on the lookout for a hero. After about 20 minutes, I hear some footsteps, and I see a young man walking by. Black cap, black shoes, well-dressed. I thought, okay. Now, let me just get something straight. I'm not good at asking for help, okay? I don't even ask my friends and family for help. I do everything on my own. So the idea of being stuck in my bathroom in New York and having to beg some stranger to help me in a Lord knows how, I'm paralyzed. But I'm also desperate. It's been about 20 minutes now, and I don't see any other possibility for help. So I get all my courage up, and I yell out the window at the top of my lungs, "Hello? Hello down there?" He doesn't hear me, so I yell louder. I have no room to be embarrassed because I'm desperate. He looks up and he stops. And I wave my hands and he sees where I am and he comes a little closer and I say, "Look, I'm locked in my bathroom. I'm new to New York. It's my first day in my apartment. My phone's outside of my bed and I have no way of getting out of here. I've tried. I can't open the door." And he goes, "Okay." He yells up to me, "Okay, well, I have a phone. Do you want me to phone someone for you?" And I'm trying to remember my best friend's number. I can't remember. I throw out a couple numbers and he tries them and there's no answer. And I realize him having a phone is going to be no help to me. So he offers to come, you know, come try and get me out of my apartment. And I say, you know, "I'm really uncomfortable asking you about this, but would you please go around to the front of the building and try getting into the building and see if you can contact my superintendent? Because I know that he has a master key and pretty much that's the only way I'm getting out of here." So he agrees to do that, and I'm like, okay, great. So he disappears around the side of the building, and I'm waiting. And for all I know, he's disappeared because, you know, I'm panicking. I'm making up all kinds of stories. But after about 10 minutes, he comes back around, and he looks up at me, and he says, "Okay, the superintendent is off today. This is the only day he's off, apparently. It's Wednesday. He's met the guy who's helping me out actually bumped into a postman in the front lobby who regularly delivers to this building. And this postman obviously informed him that George the Super is not in today and he's not going to be back till who Lord knows when. And he can't even get into the building because the front door of the building's locked. And even if he got into the front door of the building, he can't get into my apartment." So we both kind of look at each other and he really wants to help me, but I really don't know what to ask him to do. And I just, you know, I put on my cavalier voice and I said, "You know what? Don't worry about it. I'll figure something out." And I send him on his way. So now I'm sitting on my toilet. I am starting to get a little bit scared because I really can't think of how I'm ever going to get rescued. Even if the super comes back, he doesn't know I'm locked in. None of my friends know I'm locked in. I have no food in here. I have water. You know, there's the bathtub. But I can't see a way of me ever escaping. And I'm turning that into this whole story in my head that's causing all kinds of fantasies of starving in my bathroom and collapsing. And so basically, in order to calm myself, I just try and imagine the situation as part of a movie. And in the movie, something else happens. So I sit and I wait and I just try to work on my mind, be in a positive space. And suddenly, I hear a voice outside the window. And I look out and it's a man dressed in a uniform. And he looks up and he says, "Is anyone in there? Someone stuck in their bathroom?" And I peer out and I see that it's the postman. He says that he's the postman that the other guy had bumped into in the front lobby. And I look at him and I, you know, I'm so wanting him to help me, but again, we're in the same situation. What is he going to do to help me? Even if he gets in the front door, he can't get into my building. So he looks up and he says, "You know, if you're locked into your apartment, I might be able to jimmy the door open with my credit card, if only your bottom lock is locked." And I thought about it and I said, "Absolutely, it's only my bottom lock." And the thought of him being able to break into my apartment just totally gave me a euphoric possibility. So I said, "Please, please, would you do that? Break into my apartment. If you rescue me, I will love you forever." And so he goes around to the side of the building, and this is my last chance, basically. I'm hoping that it'll work. I'm sitting on the toilet. I'm praying to a God I don't even believe in, and I wait. After about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'm not hearing anything. 15 minutes later, I hear some jiggling at the front door and some noises in my apartment, and I realize he's inside. So I get up from the toilet, and I start banging on the inside of the bathroom door. I'm in here. And he goes, okay, stand back. I'm coming in. So I stand back away from the door, and he pushes it in with the side of his body, and the door flings open. And finally, I'm free. And I run up, and I douse him in a whole bunch of hugs, and I look him in the eye, and I say, you're my hero. And he says, wow, thank you. And he looks at me, and he says, you know, I really liked the I love you forever part. And I said, I do. I so love you forever. And then he got a little bit shy, and he said, well, you know, if you're new to town, maybe I could get your number, and I could show you around sometime. He was so adorable. I mean, he looked like a total local hero. He was 45, a little bit overweight, balding. And I wrote down my number on a piece of paper, and he said thank you, and he disappeared down the hallway, and I waved goodbye.
I'm just wondering if, you know, before you came to New York, you had this sort of thought in your head of, oh, you know, this is what New Yorkers are like, and what would that be?
I have to be honest. I'd heard stories about cynical, busy, very serious New Yorkers. But every time I visited New York, it unfurled in front of me like a red carpet. Everybody loves me in New York. Like, I just met friendly people, people who were willing to go out of their way for me, people willing to help me when I was lost or stuck. Just so I fell in love with the city, I fell in love with the vibe, and I fell in love with what response I got from the people. And so when I got locked in my bathroom, I knew that someone would rescue me. All it took is me being brave enough to actually be willing to ask for help. And that was a breakthrough for me. And I have to be really honest, it was really exciting for someone who's very independent, very strong, and who doesn't usually rely on other people to be forced in a situation where they have to ask for help. I actually felt, I hate to admit this, but I actually felt feminine and excited by literally being the damsel in distress. And that's really what was my take home from the whole adventure, is that I like being helped, and New Yorkers just seem always available to do just that.
You know, as you were shouting down at people on the street, what did you think that they were thinking was going on? I mean, did it at any point strike you as sort of the ultimate romantic scenario?
That's actually funny that you say that. It was. And the first guy who walked by was actually really cute. And I know I'm single. I'm new to New York. And I thought, wow, can you imagine meeting someone like that? Check this out. So the postman who rescued me, I gave him my real number because I was just so grateful. And he was so surprised when he called that it got through to me. He was convinced that it wasn't my real number. And he'd been thinking about me all day. He'd talked to his line supervisor and she'd said, this is fate, you know, this doesn't happen every day. And he wanted to take me out. He was really excited. The next day, I found a teddy bear tied to my front door. Okay, and a little note from him saying, you know, hello, I was just passing by. 2 weeks later was Valentine's Day. I got 12 roses at my front door from this postman. And he would call me during the week and we'd have these chats. And I got to be honest, you know, I'm a young, attractive woman, and he was adorable, but, you know, older man, balding, twice divorced, 2 kids, just a different space for me in life. And he was really enrolled in the possibility that we could be something for each other. And I love that about New York. Really, anything's possible here. At no point in time did he think it couldn't work. And I loved that open naivete. It actually endeared me to him.
I hate to ask this question, but how did you eventually disavow him of this notion?
We had a really long, authentic talk where I represented to him where I was in the scenario and made it very clear that I'd love to participate in his life as a friend, but I didn't think there was a romantic potential. And, you know, I talked to a few friends about it before I actually had the conversation. I could have lied to him and said I have a boyfriend. I just wanted to be honest, and I wanted to let him know that I'm so grateful for what he did. He went out of his way for me. But I also wanted to let him know that he was right to be forward with his affection, and I wanted to make it clear that he should never not risk that again. So I wanted to encourage him to continue to be naked and honest with people, but also let him know that it wasn't going to happen here. And he took it well. He took it great. And, you know, if I were to ever bump into him on the street, it would just be a big hug.
Did you at any point find yourself laughing?
Absolutely. That was in the first half an hour. The first half an hour, I was laughing hysterically. But it was that kind of laugh, and it's like a nervous laugh, and it was at the level of delirium. I was laughing at the situation. I was laughing at myself. I was laughing as a response to the intensity. And I think laughing is a natural human response to relieve tension. I was laughing uncontrollably, as if my life depended on it. And I think it did.
That was writer Annie Lala talking about being locked in her bathroom. That feature was put together by independent producer Eric Winnick. That story was brought to you by Storyboard, where everyone has a story. For more information, visit them online at storyboardaudio.com. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Hollywood likes to cast stars as pioneering scientists. It really happened in the 1940s. Hedy Lamarr was once billed as the most beautiful woman in the world, and she's partly responsible for the telecom innovations behind cell phones, GPS, and Wi-Fi. More from independent producer Eric Malinsky.
Now, would you mind saying that again rather slowly?
I came here to ask you to marry me.
Why?
Because you have no money.
The communications world of technology as we know it, cell phones, GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, it can all be traced back to Hedy Lamarr, the movie actress. I know, it's like saying Rita Hayworth invented the video game. And if this were the story of a movie, it might just seem wacky.
It's not a word I use normally, by the way. It's your word, wacky. It's quite wacky for a film star and a piano player to come up with an idea like that, which is so important in technological terms nowadays.
This is Rob Walters. He wrote a book called Hedy Lamarr and the Mobile Phone. He says the story begins at a Hollywood party in 1940. Hedy Lamarr meets a musician named George Antheil.
They met quite deliberately, although I don't think George knew, so that she could discuss the possibility of enlarging her breasts.
I know this is getting even wackier, but it's true.
Yeah, so he had a bit of a reputation in Hollywood for recommending certain things that could be done to stimulate the glandular system.
Long before the age of silicone implants. Hedy Lamarr talked with him for a while, and then she left the party. He thought that was going to be the end of it, but
when he went out to the car park, she had scrawled her telephone number across his windscreen in lipstick.
Her interest in George wasn't necessarily romantic. She wanted to pick his brain. Okay, a little background on Hedy Lamarr. She'd been married to an arms dealer in Vienna, and even though he was Jewish, he was working for the Nazis. And she was both fascinated by his work because she had the scientific mind and just absolutely disgusted by who he was working for. So naturally, by the time she had gotten to the United States, she really wanted to help the war effort. And she couldn't stop thinking about torpedoes.
Torpedoes, when launched from a ship, normally just take the course that the ship was on. If the ship that they're aiming at, or submarine or whatever, moves out of the way, they can avoid the torpedo. And they were easily traced. They ran off compressed air, so you could see a stream of bubbles behind them.
Now, a ship could conceivably control a torpedo using radio waves. But the problem was always encryption, because the enemy, using a radio, could listen in and, you know, even take control of the torpedo. So this was the idea that Hetty wanted to talk to George about. What if the transmission between the ship and the torpedo was broken into little pieces and then spread across the entire radio spectrum?
The problem is, a very simple problem, how do you make sure that you're exactly in step?
And here's why an experimental composer like George Antheil could solve this problem.
George knew how to synchronize pianolas.
He wrote a famous composition called Ballet Mécanique that had 16 automatic pianos playing in sync. So George said, well, what if you put a tiny piano roll inside the torpedo?
And of course, the ship has exactly the same roll as the torpedo.
The holes in the roll determine the frequency that the ship and the torpedo could receive transmissions. They got a professor at Caltech to draw up the patent, and they gave it to the U.S. Navy. And the Navy actually considered it, but the mechanics would have been cumbersome and unreliable.
So they went back to their normal lives of being an actress and a piano player.
Fade to black.
By 1958, the first computer chips are being used.
Retired Colonel David Hughes picks up the story from here.
Contract engineer for the Navy pulled that patent off the shelf and had no idea that it was Hetty Lamarr because it was a U.S. naval patent at this time. And then he used a pair of computer chips which could basically synchronize at both ends. And by 1962, the U.S. Navy then had frequency hopping for secure, classified naval communications. And so that went on for the next 40-some years.
The Navy engineers called it frequency hopping, which always sounded to me like the name of a swing dance. But the official name was CDMA, Code Division Multiple Access. In 1985, CDMA was declassified for commercial use. Now, at that time, the emerging cell phone industry was in the midst of a big fight over which standard to use. And this one electrical engineer named Irwin Jacobs saw the potential of CDMA. He just started a company called Qualcomm, which is now, you know, a cell phone giant. And he spent years trying to convince his colleagues that CDMA had to be the industry standard.
And during that period, there were some professors being quoted from, two in particular from Stanford, that were quoted as saying that CDMA violated the laws of physics, that it would never work.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you were really just a believer throughout this whole process, long process.
Right. I would wake up at 4 a.m. and, you know, try to think, well, is there some technical point, a marketing point that we're missing that's going to cause this whole thing to stop? But luckily, we managed to bridge all those issues.
Now, when did you find out that Hetty Lamarr was connected to this?
Actually, someone sent us a note about that after we had already started to commercialize CDMA. So I was not aware of it until fairly late in the game.
Now, in the early 90s, Colonel David Hughes was researching the history of frequency hopping. He came across the original patent.
The name of the patent was under Hedwig Keisler.
Well, he knew that Hedwig Keisler was the real name of Hetty Lamarr.
Well, sure, I was in love with her when I was 13 and she was 24.
We truly treated you badly.
Badly and foolishly as well. Your offer is ridiculous.
The invention of Hetty Lamarr and George Antheil evolved into a family of technologies that we call spread spectrum. It's the world we live in today, 3G, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, GPS. And I know this sounds like the end of a movie, and it might be soon. I was tipped off to this story when I met a filmmaker at a party named Amy Redford. She and her colleagues are working on the script of a Hetty Lamarr movie.
And the thing that's wonderful is you go from seeing her sketching out these incredibly complex concepts on cocktail napkins, and then the next thing you know, she's in like a Vegas-style headdress, standing there and not being able to say anything, being told to shut up by a director.
She's an interesting theory about Hetty Lamarr's motivations.
This invention was also her personal redemption. I think she needed to do this. She was, you know, in some ways complicit. She married a guy who was selling arms to the Nazis. And, you know, she comes from a Jewish background. And there's things that she needed to do for her own personal sense of self, as well as for, you know, society and the world at large. In history, so many inventions that were meant to bring people together that ended up being used in war. And this is one that was meant to be applied in war and ended up bringing people together.
I'm Eric Molinsky.
I'm dialing the number for Hetty
Still to come, one man's story about the secret dirty pictures his father drew, and Faster Pussycat Kill Kill star Tora Satana. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. One way to deal with the death of a parent or friend is to cling to the objects we associated with their lives. Dana Gifford's father was a commercial artist, so it's not surprising that the memory of his dad is tied to the drawings, paintings, and sculptures he left behind when he died. But among his dad's work is a collection of secret art, boxes of illustrations that were always kept private, hidden in the back of a closet. Gifford has long puzzled over what to do with his father's secret drawings, and after 10 years, he finally figured out a way to bring them into the light. Hear now the story from independent producer Ken Cormier.
My name is Dana Gifford, and I've written a book named Shunga, featuring the illustrations of my late father, Dudley Gifford. He was 54 when I was born, so I knew him for less than half of his life. He served in World War II as an artist. He did ordnance drawings. He painted aircraft models for recognition, that sort of stuff. In the 70s, he got hired to work for a company called The Communicators, and they made film strips, educational film strips for school, the old style, when you hear the tone, click the lever, picture changes, film strips. He never seemed to really pursue showing his art. His thing was, he made money off of it. He was a commercial artist. And that's how he supported his family and himself, was making art. We were playing hide and seek. My parents had this closet. And I had scoped out the top shelf of the closet. It was a really small shelf, and it was really uncomfortable. And there was this set of boxes that was jabbing into my back. So I looked in it, and it was these cartoons. It was mainly cartoons, single-panel cartoons. And, you know, I had no idea. I had no idea what this was that I was looking at, but there were naked ladies, drawings of naked ladies. It would be like coming across a Playboy and looking for all the good stuff, and everything in this was good. And he was always so cool about all of it. He wasn't like, what are you kids doing in there? You know, it was nothing like that. He just came in and he was like, hey, you can't be climbing up on this shelf. Get out of there. And, you know, and then the next time I had an opportunity to look again, the thing was tied up, and it was tied up. It wasn't just like, you know, you go around it in one direction, you go around the other direction, you tie a bow. This was like cargo netting. This was every square inch. He had like macrameed this thing. So it sort of, you know, I always knew it was there, but you know, it was beyond my reach at that point. Dad was really proficient at what he did for the film strips. So he'd finish what he was supposed to be doing, and then he would probably gather up all these scraps of illustration board and start doing naughty pictures. And he would simply draw. And if you came by to see what he was doing, he would put something on top of what he was doing and talk to you like nothing was going on. So a lot of the stuff is on odd-sized pieces of paper. It's not like he has an 8.5 by 11 sheet and he just drew on it. It was usually scrap pieces of illustration board. So it's really high quality material. And then he also has stuff which is on old memos from the hospital he worked at, which was something that came up later on in life. He worked at a local hospital as a painter, as a maintenance guy. You know, paint rooms and walls or wallpaper and that sort of stuff. The longer he was there, the more freedom they let him have. The employee cafeteria, he did a huge two-wall mural of a local waterfall. Maternity room, the actual delivery room, he painted clouds on the ceiling. In the pediatric center, he painted like robots with chest plates, which were the oxygen ports, clowns tumbling off of paper towel holders and that sort of stuff. The only naughty thing I know he did at the hospital was the x-ray technicians had this office that was buried in the bowels of the hospital. They gave him a wall and they said, you know, do something for us, Dud. And he painted this ornate gold frame with this bucolic landscape with naked ladies running all around. And I mean, it wasn't raunchy or anything. It was just, you know, little naked ladies running around on this landscape. My wife and I were on our way to a wedding. I got a call from my mother en route saying that my father had died. And I got out to the house, and there were fire trucks and police cars and ambulances and all sorts of stuff. And I walked in, and they had him strapped up to monitors, and they had wires running off of him and everything. And there were just an ungodly number of firemen in the house. And my mom was a wreck. I sort of took the initiative and sort of did a little growing up right then and was just like, what's going on? And they were like, well, he's got no respiration and he's got no heartbeat and he's got no pulse and his body temperature is dropping. And I was like, so basically you're saying he's dead. I want all of this equipment off of him and I want all of you out of the house and off of the lawn immediately. And they did. In the state of Connecticut, when you have a dead body, not just anybody can come and pick it up. It has to be a funeral home, and the police have to be present until the funeral home takes it away. So my mother and I weren't really I wasn't really getting along with her at the time all that well. And we had this cop sitting in the living room with us, with Dad sitting at his sofa, on his recliner. And I did actually say to my mother, I really want Dad's artwork. I said, I want the dirty pictures. That's what I said. I've known about it all this time. And she was like, we knew you knew about it. And I was like, well, I want it. And that was when I, you know, finally fessed up to knowing about it. It was just like, I want it. At least 1,000 individual drawings. There's probably more.
There's nothing uncomfortable about it.
I started sorting through them. I started looking at all of them.
There's nothing rude.
There's abstract pictures. There's extremely realistic pictures.
There's stuff that's really graphic in there. But
his use of color, his use of detail in the pictures. Not just the detail of the people in the pictures, but the furniture,
the rugs.
The paintings on the walls behind couples in bed.
The beds themselves.
Cartoons.
The clothes.
There's one which is a leg from like the hip down and the penis is there.
Or the pile of clothing in the corner.
I mean, every single person in that book.
And there's not a common body type.
I mean, there are people who are rail thin. There are people who are overweight.
There's not a predominant hair color.
The variety is just fantastic.
Which is another thing.
It's
fun.
That's basically what it comes down to. And It's joyful. I don't know. When I saw this stuff, I just felt that it warranted being shared with people.
That was Dana Gifford talking about his father's drawings. That story came from independent producer Ken Cormier. This is Sidetrack.
Your old man's been blasted out of his wheels, and your king-sized brother's been twisted like a pretzel. You're all that's left, lover, and you ain't gonna be around for long.
I don't believe it.
You better believe it.
A clip from the end of Russ Meyer's cult classic, Faster Pussycats Kill Kill, featuring Tora Satana as the powerful and deadly Varla. Satana is best known for that role, but she did also star in other cult films like Astro Zombies and The Doll Squad, and she appeared in many popular 60s TV shows. She is still very active, attending conventions and still acting. In fact, she will be reprising her role of Varla in a new animated film from rocker Rob Zombie. I talked with Satana recently about her life, her cult status, her soon-to-be-published life story, and her relationship with Elvis Presley. I asked her to start with a 10-second synopsis of Faster Pussycat.
Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is about three go-go dancers who take a trip into the desert, wind up killing somebody, and going in search of an old man's money that he got as a settlement, and wind up killing everybody, basically, on the ranch except for two people.
It actually is much more fun than you make it out to be.
Of course it is.
40 years on, you know, people are still talking about this movie, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. You are a cult movie icon, no doubt about it. How does that feel? I mean, you can't deny that.
Well, I never really thought about it. You know, I know that when I first did the film, I did it basically tongue-in-cheek, where I wanted to get rid of a lot of anger, and that film helped me do that.
Well, nowadays, there are comic books about you and your character Varla from Faster Pussycat. I've seen lunchboxes, Faster Pussycat lunchboxes, and now there's a statue coming out. Is that all a bit surreal to you?
Well, yeah. Why did they wait so long? It's one of the things I want to know. But no, the lunchboxes, yeah, they're definitely out there, and as for the statue, it was the artist who came to me, and he said I saw your performance in Faster Pussycat Kill. He said I just have to do a figure of you, and I said, oh well, okay.
Well, going back to when you actually made the movie, what was it like working with Russ Meyer and the rest of the cast?
Well, working with Russ was not difficult at all, because he was very easygoing when it came to dialogue. He knew what he wanted camera-wise, and he set, if something set well with him, he would shoot it in different angles and stuff like that. But some of the dialogue was from about the 1940s, 1950s, and it was not something that that girls of that day or that era would use. So we were able to ad lib, and got a couple of nice lines in there. And the weird part about it is that, as far as Russ and I were concerned, we stayed friends for all the years that he lived until he passed away. He always used to tell me, you know, that it was just the two of us that made that movie. Oh, really? I says, what happened to the other people? And he says, well, they were superficial.
Well, when you think about that character, Varla, she is very much a superhero. You know, have you ever thought about it in that way? Because she's a very powerful character, and I know an inspiration to a lot of people, especially women.
that's what surprised me a little bit, was the fact that Varla became such an icon for women, and a lot of battered women. Because I used to get emails all the time from battered women who said, I saw your performance in Faster Pussycat, and you have changed my life. They say, I realize that I don't have to be ashamed because I've got big boobs. And I don't have to be ashamed because, you know, I'm not a carpet to walk on. And I said, no, honey, you're not. What you have to be, I said, is strong, first of all. Know what you want, go get it. And once you get it, keep it.
Well, I think one of the reasons that role resonates with people, because it's very honest, and it seems to have grown sort of organically from you as a person, and reading through your life story, what there is out there, it's very easy to understand how you brought your own history into that role. And, you know, the rough life you lived growing up in Chicago, and the girl gangs you got involved with. Talk a little bit about that experience growing up.
Well, basically, I basically had to toughen up, because the neighborhood they moved us into was a gangster neighborhood, basically. You know, and they moved us into a housing project.
And they moved you in from a Japanese
internment camp.
Yeah, internment camp.
Yeah, yeah, from Manzanar. Anyway, they put us there, and we went to. Well, I think it was a Jane Addams Housing Project. I think that's the name of it now, but I don't know if it's still there or not. It's in Chicago. And I went to a Jacob A. Riis Grammar School. When I went to school, I used to have to, because I looked different than all of them, because I was not black, I wasn't Italian, I wasn't blonde and Jewish, I was Oriental. And I had black hair, slanted eyes, you know. So I used to have to fight my way to and from school every day. So my dad started teaching me some of the martial arts, some Aikido, to help some of that along. But then there was a black girl gang that used to gang up on me when I'd be heading home, because they wanted me to do their homework for them. Because I was just, you know, like a superior student. It was one of those things where I had to learn. I had to learn to be tough. I had to learn to stand up for myself. And I had to learn to roll with the punches, as far as being called Tojo's daughter and you know, cheeky Chinaman and stuff like that. The racial slurs and the stuff like that, they hurt, but I never let them know it, you know. So it was just one way of being able to cope with life in general. And when I got a little older, after I spent a little time in juvenile hall because I got raped by five guys, I wound up just basically touring my neighborhood with a bunch of other girls that became my friends, because they knew if they became my friends, nobody would pick on them, because no longer did anybody pick on me. We did our little gang, our little girl gang thing, and with our boots and our leather coats, and watching the neighborhood so that nobody else got raped and nobody else got hurt.
So let me ask you this. How much of Varla really was you, and how much of it was the total opposite of you?
I would say about 75% of Varla was me, and the other 25% would have been the fact that I'm really a pussycat until you rile my temper, and then I'm no longer a pussycat. Prior to that, I'm supposedly, I guess, one of the nicest people I know.
Well, that is actually true, because when I've met you, I was actually kind of taken aback by how un-Varla-like you really are in real life.
Yes, that's the one part that always astounds me. People expect me to be just exactly like Varla. But Varla was a character, you know, and I put a lot of me into her, but she was still a character. I am a very caring person. I love my friends, and I'm very faithful to them and very loyal to them. Any of them ever got hurt or anything like that, I would be right there for them. Varla wouldn't. Varla would have gone off. She'd gone off on her own. Says,
well, oh, she put a knife into one of her friend's back in the movie.
Yes.
Now, you are currently working on your biography, correct?
Yes.
And do you have a date when that will be published?
Hopefully it'll be by the end of this year.
Oh, so it's going to be coming out pretty soon.
It should, yeah. The only thing I'm adding to it right now is pictures. They're doing the editing on it, and then I'm adding photos from my life, various stages of it.
So what sorts of things will we be reading about in your biography? Anything you can disclose for us?
Oh, basically, you're going to be learning about my girl gang and how I got started, basically, in the film industry. I'm also writing my life as a stripper.
Which was a big part of your early career, was as a burlesque performer.
Yeah, that's. I figured I'd do that differently than the one for the film, because I feel that there's a lot of misunderstanding is the only word I can think of. When strippers were in my era, we were taught to be graceful. We were taught to be enticing. We were taught to be a tease. We were taught to be a tease, you know, and to titillate the customers, but do it with class. That's one of the things I want to put in there also.
Well, you aren't shy in your MySpace page and on your website talking about some of the famous men you've known, including Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And this story amazes me. You say that he actually asked you to marry him.
Yes.
And you said no.
Right.
Well, tell me more.
Oh, well, if I'd have married him when he asked me to marry him, his career would have been blown so far out into outer space that it had never come back. You know, and I could not see him blowing his career just, you know, to marry me.
And at the time, you were still a burlesque dancer, right?
Right. I was still a stripper, and back then, strippers were not classified as very nice ladies. That was one of the things that the colonel really was ticked off about. He kept telling me that he could change me into a singer, and I said, why? And he says, because. He says, you've got a great voice. He says, but. He says, you've got a great body, too. And I said, I already know about the body. And I did. I used to sing quite often when I was younger. I was the school soloist, and I was, you know, I started out as a singer and then found out that I could make more money taking my clothes off.
Also, you talk about, after you said no to Elvis, he went on to marry Priscilla Presley, but in his own way, he didn't forget you. Tell me a little bit about how that took shape.
Have you seen Priscilla Presley's pictures when they first started going
together? Oh, absolutely.
Who does she look like?
Well, according to your story, Elvis made her to look like you.
Yes. And he put stage makeup on her, you know, when it was totally unnecessary. She's a gorgeous lady. She didn't need that, you know, but he tried to make her look like me. When he knew me, and I was dancing on stage, I always wore heavy makeup then, but, you know, like, I never wore it out in public. I used to tell him, you have to stop this. And he says, why? And I says, because. I said, you're not letting her be herself. I said, you're trying to make her into me. He says, But he told me, he said that that's what he wanted, you know, and I said, that's not fair. That's not fair to her. I guess eventually he gave up on it because she started changing.
Well, do you ever regret not marrying Elvis?
Yes, I do, because I think if I had married him, he'd still be alive.
Well, you're still very active, working on all sorts of projects. As we talked about earlier, you're the statue that's being made of you. You go to these conventions. You're writing your biography. Is there anything else for you to do? Is there anything else you want to do?
Yeah, we're going to make little doll. We're going to make dolls of Varla.
Action figures?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And a little, you know, see what we can come up with.
That was Tora Satana, star of the cult classic film Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. You can find her online at torasatana.com and on MySpace at myspace.com/tsatana. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.